3. St. Jonah Redux, Atlanta, regarding January 12, 2011. The way I heard it, Miss Esme Symes was born Esther Simon, the youngest daughter of an evangelical minister who spoke in tongues, handled rattlesnakes, and drank strychnine from ball mason jars. There are 2 or 3 different stories floating around about why she up and left that pissant backwater Florida town, but they all come back around to her daddy not keeping his hands to himself. Might be she killed him, might be her mama killed him, might be the man only lost his ministry to the scandal and slunk off into the Everglades to drink away whatever was left of his miserable, sorry life. Whichever, Esther became Esme, and she spent some time with a traveling show, reading poems and tarot cards, telling rubes what they'd want to hear about their futures instead of telling them what she really saw. Oh, I'm not saying I believe she was a bona fide psychic or clairvoyant or whatever, but that lady, she most definitely made a living convincing people she was, and, to tell the God's honest truth, if I'm going to deny there's anything to all this sixth sense falderal, well, then I'm left with the mystery of how exactly it was she led 2 detectives from APD Homicide to that empty warehouse between Spring Street and West Peachtree. Of course, it wasn't the first time she'd helped the police. There was that kid who'd gone missing out in Stone Mountain 2 years earlier, and there was the Decatur woman who'd been raped, murdered, dismembered, and buried in her own backyard. Remember her? Well, Esme found both of them. So when she made the call about the warehouse, we sat up and listened. Now, if she'd been up front and warned us what she thought we were going to find in there, I like to think someone would have had the good sense to hang up on her. Tell her to go fuck herself. But apparently, full disclosure was not that woman's style. And looking back, the whole day seems sorta like walking into an ambush, climbing the 3 flights of stairs up to that long fucking hall, and then she told us, go all the way down to the end. That's where we'd find what we were looking for, down at the end of the hall. Franklin Babineau, that skinny kid from New Orleans, he's first into the room, and then me, and then Audrey. Yeah, she's still my partner, right? This was still 6 months or so before her accident. Anyway, so by the time I make it through the door, Babno, he's already gotten a big juicy eyeful, and he's sorta just standing off to the side, fucking dumbstruck, gawking. And there before us was the nightmare that Esme Symes had neglected to elaborate on. My first thought, I shit you not, my very first thought was how it all had to be some sort of sick-ass practical joke. Something like that. Your brain doesn't want to admit you're really seeing what you think you're seeing, and if you are seeing it, well, then it can't possibly be what it looks like. Oh, you've seen the photos, I know. But the photos, let me assure you, they don't convey 1/100th of the sheer surreal fucked-upness. The photos, they're like a fading memory of the real thing, like, let's say, a copy of a copy. For one, you look at them and you don't get the smell, like a fish market or a salt marsh at low tide. And just beneath the oily, fishy ocean smell, there was the sharp metallic stink of all that blood. So you take away the smell, and you take away that punch to the gut. Thanks, sweet damn Jesus, it was winter. I don't even want to imagine what it would have been like walking into that shitstorm in July instead of January. But like I said, first thing through my head was that someone had set it all up just to fuck with us. Because right there in front of me, hanging from the ceiling, was this goddamn 14-foot great white shark. The tip of its nose was just barely touching the concrete floor. I knew what kind of shark it was, because when I was a kid, my dad and me, we used to deep-sea fish down in Destin, and once one of his buddies landed a great white. Only the one in the warehouse was bigger. A lot bigger. Probably right then, it looked like just about the biggest goddamn fish ever was. Later I heard it weighed in at something like 1,500 pounds. Anyway, the shark had been suspended from a hook, from a block and tackle rig that had been set into the ceiling of that place, a rope looped around the shark's tail. Its jaws were bulging out of its mouth, just because of gravity, I guess, because of its own weight. There were rows and rows of glistening triangular teeth big as my damn thumb, serrated like a steak knife, and its eyes were bugging out, too. Those horrible black fucking eyes, Even when a shark's alive, its eyes look dead. Of course, you know that's not the worst of it. Not even close. That fish was just the opening act, right? So there we are, and the initial shock's beginning to fade. Audrey, I remember she started in laughing. At the time it pissed me off, but now I get it. I mean, it really is like the setup for a bad joke, right? Three cops walk into an empty warehouse in downtown Atlanta. There's a fucking dead shark hanging from the ceiling. One cop says to the other cop, "Who brought the hush puppies?" and etc. Real funny. Anyway, I remember Babineau looking over at me like, "Hey man, you know what this is, right? You've seen this shit before, right?" Me, I'm just trying to let it all sink in, okay? Because it's not just the shark. There's this enormous design drawn on the concrete floor, sort of painted on the floor in red sand. You know, like those Tibetan monks do. Later, one of the specialists that the department called in, an anthropologist from Georgia Tech, he said the design was a mandala, like in Hindu religion. To me, what it put me in mind of was a maze, and right at the center of all those parallel lines, all those circles inside circles, was the shark. "Call it in," I say to Babineau and Audrey. She says to me, "What the fuck is he supposed to call it in as?" I was the one who found the body. But you know that too. Those lines of sand on the floor, they were spaced just far enough apart from each other that you could get to the shark without stepping on them. Straight off, I felt this instinctual sort of revulsion at the thought of doing that, putting a foot down on one of those lines. Step on a crack, break your mama's back, right? So while Babineau is making the call, I go and ignore that little nagging voice in the back of my head that's telling me just to get the fuck out and let someone else deal with this crazy shit. Audrey, she tells me we should wait for the ME, and when she says that, I swear she sounds scared. And that also pisses me off. "Christ," I tell her, "it's just a goddamn fish. What the fuck?" All the same, crossing that space between the doorway and the shark, and it couldn't have been more than 10 feet, I am perfectly cognizant how I'm being so careful not to step on even one of those lines, acting like some superstitious 7-year-old. And hey, that's something else pissing me off. That's the thing that pisses me off the worst. I get up close and I see how the shark's belly is split open right down the middle. Well, not just its belly. The fish has been sliced open from the underside of its head, most of the way back to the tail. And here and there it's been sewn shut again with nylon fishing line. We couldn't see that when we first came in because of the angle it was hanging at. Anyway, this doesn't come as a surprise. No reason it should. You catch a fish, you gut it. And who the hell ever had gone to the trouble to drag a 15-foot great white shark up 3 flights of stairs? Surely they'd have done themselves the favor of not hauling along the extra weight of its innards. That's just plain common sense. "They're on their way," says Babineau. I reach into a pocket and pull out a pair of latex gloves, and that's when I see 3 fingers poking through between a gap in those nylon stitches. A thumb, an index finger, the middle fucking finger. A woman's fingers with this deep red nail polish, some shade of red so dark it's almost black. And the fingers, they're fucking moving, okay? I yell, "We need an ambulance. We need a fucking ambulance right fucking now," or some shit like that, and I'm digging around in my coat trying to find my pocket knife. Next thing I know, Audrey's standing there beside me, and Jesus God, the look on her face. I could talk all day, and I would never come up with words to convey that expression. She starts in tugging at the fishing line with her hands, but it's slippery with blood and oil and shit, and the line's like, you know, 100-pound monofilament test. Finally, I get my knife out and start cutting. And whenever I come to this part of the story, it's always like looking back, like right here a flashbulb goes off in my head or something. Suddenly, everything is so clear, so stark, more real than real, and I know that doesn't make sense. I get that, see, but I don't know what would. If you've ever been in a car crash, it's kind of like that, that exact instant when 2 cars collide. A moment that seems so perfectly defined, but that also seems sort of smeared. Anyway, It doesn't take me all that long to get the fish's belly open again. I nick myself once or twice in the process, but I don't even realize that until later when the EMTs arrive. I have a scar on my left palm from that day. Souvenirs, right? Yeah, she was still alive, the woman they'd stitched up inside the dead fish. Only barely, but, well, you've read the files. You probably read the book that cocksucker from New York City wrote about the whole thing. So you know how it was. We're standing there, and Audrey, she's saying, "Oh, God. Oh, dear God. Oh, God." Over and over. And back behind us, Babineau was praying the fucking rosary or some other sort of Catholic mumbo-jumbo. The woman in the shark, she's completely naked, and she looks maybe 25, probably younger, but it's hard to tell much because she's covered head to toe in rotting shark. "We have to get her out of there," says Audrey, and I'm holding the sides of the fish's belly open, and Audrey, she's leaning in and putting her arms around the woman. Thank fuck she wasn't conscious. I think that's the one small piece of mercy we got that day, that she wasn't conscious. Audrey's in up to her shoulders, and I'm starting to gag from the stink. I just know I have maybe 10 seconds before I spew coffee and Krispy Kreme donuts, and that's when Audrey says, "Oh, Jesus, Mike, they've been sewn together." "What?" I ask. "What's been sewn together?"
"She's sewn in here," Audrey replies. "Sewn to the fucking fish."
And there's this terrible brittle tone in her voice, like eggshells. I'm never gonna forget the way she sounded. And that's when I see what the woman inside the shark is holding. The sons of bitches who'd done it to her. They arranged her hands, sewed them together too, so that she's cradling the thing in her palms. She seems to be holding it out to us like an offering. Only, I know it isn't 3 cops that offering is meant for. I don't know what the fuck I was thinking. Hell, I'm not thinking. I'm running on shock and instinct, shit like that. I take it from her hands, that jade idol, what the fuck ever it is, and I just stand there holding it, staring at it. You spend 15 years on the Force, and you think maybe you've seen evil. Maybe you've stared at it in the face enough times that you and evil are chummy old acquaintances. But I know right then how wrong I was to ever believe I've seen evil. That chunk of rock, not much bigger than a plum, it's evil. True and absolute, indescribable, and I want to put it down. More than anything, I just want to set it down on the floor with the lines of red sand. But I can't. Sounds hokey as hell, but it's like that Nietzsche quote, the one about staring into the abyss and it staring back into you. I'm still standing there holding that thing when backup arrives. They have to pry it out of my hands. As for Esme Symes, 1 week later she hangs herself with an extension cord. She was brought in twice for questioning, so I think she knew she was the closest thing we had to a suspect, that she was in the department's sights. The DA's screaming for blood. And her apartment? It's fucking wallpapered with sketches of that goddamn jade atrocity, right? Dozens and dozens of sketches from all different angles. But she doesn't leave a note. Not unless you're gonna call all those drawings a suicide note. You ask me, and I know you didn't, but you ask me whether she was involved or not, and all I gotta say is Miss Esme Symes got off easy. She got off scot-fucking-free.